Super K.
It's time for fun, and no one else can do it better. And it feels alright, because it's Super K time. Let's have some Super K fun. Yes, it's Super
right.
K time.
Hello, welcome to Super Gay, a podcast for comic book gays. I'm Johnny Jungle Guts.
And I'm Professor Extra.
This is the podcast where we talk about all things gay in comics and more.
But mostly comics.
Super K!
And today we are talking about the Young Avengers for the second time. We did an episode about the Young Avengers, Alan Heinberg era earlier in our podcast's lifetime. Mm-hmm. But now we're back with the newer, but still kind of older, Young Avengers from 2013 by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. But before we dive into that, let's just bring up a few things from the last couple episodes that we regrettably left out.
Right. So one thing I wanted to say is that we forgot in all of our discussion of Batwoman to mention that Batwoman is Jewish.
It seems important.
The other thing, we just recorded an episode with our friend Daniel Randell about He-Man, and he's a big He-Man fan, and while we were taping it, we had a lot of things we were trying to explore and understand, and neither you nor I are really huge He-Man fans, would you say?
I was completely new to the universe of He-Man.
Yeah, but I've been thinking about it since then, and I think that although for Danny, he was able to really see it as a kind of queer family story or something like that. For me, I think He-Man is homophobic and body shaming.
I think it's definitely devoid of queer characters and also devoid of a variety of physiques. But I also would counterpoint that by saying that to a certain extent, almost all the media we talk about on this show is body shaming, with the exception of the one episode where we talked about different bodies in comics. So, He-Man
fair.
He-Man is maybe guiltier than some, because not only does everyone have huge muscles, but they also, for some reason, even the men, have tiny waists.
And the same body, which I think is more, like, he says that was a cost-cutting thing.
It sure was.
Which is true, but then what's the net result is that the only type of body that you can have is this giant muscle body with a tiny waist. It's a certain kind of masculinity that most of us don't actually live up to, if that's a goal. But also, my question is, why would you want to look that way?
No.
Anyway. All right, moving on. We have exciting news. We have a Patreon page. Johnny, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what is on the Patreon page for our amazing listeners to explore and find and pay for?
Well, we have all kinds of content that you're going to be able to pay for, including a new podcast called the John and John Comic Book Hour. It's me, Johnny Jungle Guts, with my friend John Wallace, who is a longtime comics reader. Yeah, we just are talking about new things in contemporary comics. We're from very different backgrounds. I'm a white gay guy from the suburbs of New Jersey. He's a black straight guy from South Central Los Angeles. But we both really love comics, and we love talking about it. So our first episode is talking about the Young Justice series on DC's bizarre new streaming service, All Access. Our second episode is talking about some Comicsgate stuff, and then I think we are going to do an episode about the Umbrella Academy and the heroes that inspired it, the Doom Patrol, who both have TV shows at the moment. So yeah, so that's what's coming up on Patreon. I'm also going to be posting some of my own writing. Alex is going to be posting some of his own writing. I have a very belated best television of 2018 list that I still think might be interesting to some of you. So if
that's
you want to keep this podcast going, definitely subscribe. We're going to have a couple different levels. And
absolutely. Yeah, I've listened to the first episode of John and John, and I have to say it's really fun, really charming. You guys are great together. And it was an interesting conversation about Young Justice, very different from how we would talk about it here, but nonetheless super interesting and informative and fun to listen to and funny and all that stuff. So yay. Yay, John and John.
I'm really excited, and there could be more podcasts coming to the Patreon in the future. I am constantly fantasizing about a podcast with my friend Clay Kerrigan, our friend Clay Kerrigan, where we talk about Animorphs, the pulp teen novel series from my youth. So that may be coming up as well. Who knows?
Amazing. So please, everybody, go over to Patreon and find our page and support it. Because right now we aren't really... I mean, we're supported by the kind of imaginary love that we feel from you guys. But other
and
than
and
that,
literal, we actually do have people who tell us they really like the show from time to time.
No, it's true. It's true.
That's not imaginary, but it's not monetary.
It's not monetary. So another big thing is we're going to be at FlameCon. So every single episode up until now, up until then in August, we'll be talking about it, and it's going to be really exciting. And we'll see you guys there.
I'm so excited. And for anyone who knows me, I actually hate vacations and traveling. So the fact that I am actually excited to do this is really saying, like, a lot.
It should be a lot of fun. It's going to be in, like, August 16 and 17, something like that. But we'll let you guys know.
Super K!
So, Johnny, have you been reading any comic books right now?
I have been reading two books by Michael DeForge, and I read his books, Ant Colony and One Year Healthy. Ant Colony is about an ant colony. And One Year Healthy is about a lady who gets out of a psych ward, and it's about her first year in the real world. But, of course, it being by Michael DeForge, it never feels like the real world at all. Right. But those are some comics I've really been enjoying lately.
That's nice. I'm not going to go into the X-Men stuff too much because I think that we can talk about what's happening with Age of X-Men and its kind of metaphor for sexual repression and other things that they're exploring over there at Marvel Comics with the X-Men line. I mentioned in our show notes that the X-Men is really in a kind of siloed and bifurcated moment where the straight male energy is all happening in one sort of wing of the X-Men, and then all of the queer characters and sort of more powerful women characters are all in an alternate universe right now. So I was wondering about that as a sort of strategy, a sort of marketing strategy that the comic book industry has always kind of done in a way, right? Like there's sort of boy comics and girl comics, but now it almost feels like there's sort of right-wing leaning comics and then the more, you know, social justice warrior comics on the other side.
Yeah, and I feel like this is going to maybe actually come up a little bit in our conversation about Young Avengers today, the way that this is a comic, as I understand it, that has... an entirely queer roster, a all queer team roster.
I mean, that's interesting because I have a different interpretation of them, but it's true that they do lean heavily queer, which is one of the reasons why this comic book is something that we are going to talk in depth about. A lot of the characters are currently actually in the West Coast Avengers, Kelly Thompson's book that's coming out at Marvel, which includes, of course, Hawkeye, Kate Bishop, the female Hawkeye, as the lead character, and then America Chavez, who is, you know, one of our favorite superheroes on the podcast, who, by the way, is dating the sister of the boyfriend of Kate Bishop right now in this comic book. And another character who we're going to see in Young Avengers, Marvel Boy, Novar, Kree warrior kind of fuckboy, basically, has returned.
And he did.
He's Kate's ex-boyfriend, and so he's back with her in this West Coast Avengers, which I guess at this point now is sort of the legacy book of the Young Avengers.
It's kind of the legacy book of all the gay books.
In a way, yeah. I mean, it's funny. Like, there's only really one queer character in the team officially, but it is all those books that were canceled back in the day when, we had 1 year of representation at Marvel Comics. Not to go off topic too much, but I did want to say that, you know, generally I do kind of avoid the straight male vibe of comics, particularly now that I think of us being in a sort of desublimated era where it's no longer like I have to read through, you know, the subtext all the time to find the queer content we've had conversations about Grant Morrison for sure.
Oh yeah.
But maybe similarly to how you were feeling about that Wonder Woman that you really liked. I'm really into the Green Lantern that Grant Morrison is writing with Liam Sharp's art. It is so beautiful. It's funny. It's very much what I love about kind of high sci-fi weirdness of Green Lantern stories. And it reminds me a lot of that old comic book. Remember Heavy Metal?
Of course.
Yeah, it's very Heavy Metal. Like, that's kind of the aesthetic that they're going for, and it's really great. So if you need some, like... stonery male energy, I would recommend it to the listeners. And actually, Green Lantern looks really sexy in it. You know, so.
Let's be honest about that. Yeah, it's funny. I think of Grant Morrison as like the... And this is a weird comparison, but I kind of think of him as like the Nicki Minaj of comics in that he will do really obnoxious things or just put out things that are just flat out not good. But then every once in a while, he'll just do something really fun and great that you're sucked back in again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what's going on for me with this amazing, weird, who knows how long the run will be, but this amazing, weird Green Lantern that he's doing. And you know, DC has all these great characters, and they can take redefining and reimagining really well in a way that's maybe different from how Marvel kind of works through that through legacy characters like the Young Avengers. So let's talk about the Young Avengers from 2013.
Super K!
The writer is Kieran Gillen, who is a queer British writer. Jamie McKelvey is the artist, and the colors are by Matthew Wilson. Gillen and McKelvey also worked together on independent comic Phonogram, and that led to the currently running Wicked and the Divine.
I have read a couple issues of it. I'm willing to give it more of a chance, possibly for an episode of this show.
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading it, and it's not as easy as the superhero stuff that already has built into it a kind of world, a Marvel Universe, for example. So this 2013 Young Avengers is now collected into three volumes in the TPB.
Yeah, Style is Greater Than Substance is the first book.
Okay, the second one is called Alternative Culture, and the third one is called Mic Drop at the Edge of Time and Space. Let's talk about who the characters are that appear in this comic book. Now, in the TPB, the first person we see is Miss America Chavez, and for me, this was kind of the definitive America because I had not seen the character before, and I still, when I think of her, I picture this one, even though
she'd
be so interesting and so beautifully drawn and wonderful in her solo book.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's just the difference is that her solo book I read more regularly than I read this book when it was first coming out, so that's probably why I more associate it. At first, when I was rereading this today, I was giving it maybe a little hard time because I noticed that she's not using as much Latina slang as in Gabby Rivera's book, but she definitely is using some, and I think Kieran Gillen's walking a fine line here.
Yeah, it's true. It's interesting. Have you read Vengeance, which is that comic book by Joe Casey and Nick Dragotta that she first shows up in?
I have seen images of it, but I know I've never read it.
In that, she's kind of a fly girl, sort of J-Lo type character, and she's very much a kind of heterosexual fantasy. She wears really low-cut shirts. She has like
she was wearing skimpy outfits. That's what I remember about it. And I didn't hate them, but I was like, oh, this is a little bit different if she's supposed to be like a teen character.
It's a different character. Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's a kind of over-sexualized spicy Latina if you really want to get into it.
Yeah, definitely that.
Yeah. But in this, you know, when she shows up immediately, she's kind of mysterious. She's wearing cut-off jeans, but, you know, she's got that kind of signature America style where everything's red, white, and blue, but she's not wearing low-cut shirts. She's a tough girl with big hoop earrings, you know, who happens to be from another dimension. And she is, from the get-go, a kind of Latinx character. I mean, I think one thing that Gabby Rivera is able to do with her is really develop that character more. And in this, she's sort of a mysterious backbone of the team, but she's a very important character, and she's central to all the action. And she's always in the front of the drawings, you know, all the drawings on the cover.
Sure.
She's really cool. The next character is Kid Loki. Honestly, could you explain to me what's going on there? Because Kid Loki is basically Loki, but he's young, right?
You know, Loki is just a character that has gone through many different phases. At times, Loki has been female, and I don't really know why he is a child here. I'm sure it has to do with a storyline prior to this. I just think of Loki as being very physically mutable as a mischief god or goddess. He's really the most famous character in this book.
Right.
The rest of the characters are not really known to the general public, whereas Loki is literally the villain in Avengers. So he's kind of like, I wonder a little bit, he kind of feels like he's there to anchor the book a little bit for new readers. Mm.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's some weird narrative here where he was reborn as a child, as an innocent, but then his evil spirit of his past self came and killed the child and took over its body. You know, it's that kind of stuff. But the thing you need to know, basically, is that he's younger than all the other ones in terms of appearance. He looks like he's probably like 13 or 14, maybe.
Something like that.
Nobody trusts him, and he's obviously got a scheme, but he really wants to hang out with these young Avengers, and in the end, it seems like he kind of likes them,
yes.
Based on his Instagram feed.
Yes, and anyway. He gets aged up at a certain point and becomes a lot hotter, yeah. Which I know you liked.
So hot. But anyways, okay, and then the other one, we have Hawkeye, Kate Bishop. My note here is that she's nice.
Yeah, not your favorite, I can tell, or interesting. I like this character a lot better in the original Young Avengers. It's almost the only character I think was more well-written in that original story because she was a sort of Sex and the City type character that Alan Heinberg was good at writing. He'd actually written for that show. And then again, when Kelly Thompson and Matt Fraction write her, I also like her a little better because they get her teen energy a little more right, and also she's usually in California for some reason, so I just immediately like that.
I think she has, for me, it's kind of the Batman problem. Her power is that she's a rich, white, entitled person. And so she feels like she has the right to hang out with people who have more powers than her.
Yeah.
That's just my impression. She's one of those characters who I think requires like a writer who actually has the sense of humor that she's supposed to have.
Sure.
So what do you do? But one thing I do like about her is that she wakes up, when we first see her, she's waking up in bed on a spaceship having had a one-night stand with Marvel Boy, a.k.a. Novar. Are you familiar with this? This is a Grant Morrison creation.
It sure is. And you know what? I never did after being recommended it many, many times.
But it's from this Marvel Knights line. What was that, Marvel Knights?
Okay, so Marvel Knights was Marvel's attempt to become more like adult. They always think more adult means more sex and violence, when like really oftentimes that actually makes things more like juvenile. But some of the big books from that era were, there was a Garth Ennis Punisher series, Daredevil, Elektra. It's all those kind of like New York City type characters who kind of have a little bit of powers and like a lot of tooth, you know?
I see. Well, so Marvel Boy, he's this white-haired, sexy, you know, alien type, wearing Kree-type stuff. When we first see him in this, he's in his underwear, and he's dancing around to the Ronettes or something. He's a record collector, which is another thing. And he's just kind of a sexy bad boy alien who Kate hooked up with, right? Anyway, they wake up, they had sex. And I'm kind of into him, I have to admit. There's something about the way he's drawn in relationship to the way he's portrayed as a character that makes him both really hot and disgusting at the same time, which just kind of makes him more hot.
Yeah.
But anyway, then Hulkling. He's the son of a Kree Skrull mix. He's a cute blonde boy with earrings who turns into a green shape-shifting super kid. And he's very familiar to all of us from the original Young Avengers as one of the breakout star characters, one half of a famous gay superhero boyfriends, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And he looks gayer here than he ever has, just in terms of the haircut, the earrings, and just sort of the shape of his face. And I also think in this book, they take a lot more time to really let you know that he's like a shapeshifter.
Yeah. And then his boyfriend, Wiccan, Billy Kaplan, who's the son of the Scarlet Witch. He's the brother of that character, Tommy, who is sort of like a Quicksilver type, also known as Speed. From the original Young Avengers run. He has been adopted by a nice Jewish family called the Kaplans because Scarlet Witch is a terrible mom and a terrible kind of every... She's bad at being a superhero. He is represented here again as a kind of cute, twee, brown-haired boy. His powers are reality warping, which is always a problem. And he's the other half of the famous gay boyfriends, Hulkling and Wiccan, who are always fan favorites for fan art drawings and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And then finally added to the team this time is Prodigy, a.k.a. David Alane. He's a character from Academy X, which was a period of the X-Men when they had a whole big school with lots and lots of students. It was created by writers Nunzio DeFilippis and Christina Weir, and artist Kieran Grant. And David Alane first appeared in New Mutants Volume 2, Number 4, in 2003. And I really love his power set. It's one of my favorite New Mutants power sets. Do you know what he can do?
Yes. He basically has the ability to like learn things really fast and quickly and copy people's skill sets, not their superpowers, but their knowledge and way of handling situations. But he was actually depowered at this time by Scarlet Witch during the sort of whole Decimation, House of M, No More Mutants thing.
Yeah.
He doesn't have his power to copy more people's knowledge and skills, but he retains all the ones from before.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of limited telepathy. He doesn't really even need to hear what people, although this goes back and forth depending on who's writing it. In the original version, if he was just in the room with somebody, he could pick up what they know, sort of like low-level telepathy. In this, he does kind of say things like, well, I saw Doctor Strange do this one thing once, and that's how I learned this magic word. So he's also a black character, and I guess that's one thing that's going on here that's a little different from the original team. We have a little more ethnic, racial kind of diversity on the team.
There's a critic online, his name's Son of Baldwin, very, very outspoken for black America and civil rights and all that stuff, and he really, really identifies with this character. I think partially because he is so cerebral and then normal at different turns. And I think that's probably also why you like him a lot, because he kind of reminds me of you a little bit.
Yeah, he's an interesting character because he is about being a model minority, how you're supposed to function if you want to survive within a white supremacist state.
That's interesting. I never thought about it that way.
You have to be 10,000 times smarter and work XXX harder. And so he has
and be able to mimic, other people's way of living.
Yeah. So he's really, I mean, he's somebody who I have had conversations with other people about. And, you know, he's a fairly underrepresented character. I mean, he was very prominent in that Academy X book. He's one of the main characters, and then he kind of disappears, shows up again here, and has only been a little bit around since this run. But he, for the people who know the character, he has a lot of meaning, and I think it's because a lot of us who are people of color and are nerds have kind of had similar experiences in the world that he has. Now, the plot of this book is funny to me because I don't even think the series is really about the plot.
I think that he is trying to make some different allegories. One interesting thing about this book is that it's a book with a lot of gay characters, but none of them really had particularly homophobic parents. And so, and he ends up inserting this villain called Mother, who I think in a lot of ways is a stand-in for that homophobic mom.
Interesting.
Even though never literally. She never is like mad at them for being gay, but she is just very controlling and destructive. Yeah. And also no other adults really understand, like literally understand what these kids are going through.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think that there we do have a real kind of allegory for just generational difference. And this is, I think, in a lot of ways, one of the first teams that I've read that I really thought, like, these are millennials in a way that some of the other teams that I've seen, young teams that come before, I mean, you could say, probably argue the Runaways in a sense too, but they, to me, still have a very Gen X flavor to them because of the age of the writers, I think, in fact, and the kind of aesthetics of that moment that they come from.
I mean, this was during the height of Tumblr, 2013.
And
so you see them literally on Tumblr, but sometimes I felt like at the time it was like pushing that a little too hard, the social media, stuff. But now going back over it, it annoys me a little less. But I think at the time it was because I was really heavy on Tumblr and I was like, don't pander to me. That's how I felt at the time, you know? Right.
I mean, I'm older than you. And for me, reading these characters, I thought, like, well, this is interesting because now we have a group of characters who don't have to be anxious in the same way about their queerness, whose parents are probably, you know, like the Kaplans. I mean, and when we start this comic book out, in book number one, Style is Greater Than Substance, it picks up right after the events of the Children's Crusade, which is when that character Cassie Stature died. And the kids have kind of decided not to be heroes anymore. And Teddy and Billy are living together since Teddy's mom is dead at Billy's house. Now, the parents have made a rule that they can't be in each other's bedrooms after a certain hour, which I think is interesting. But they basically have allowed him to move his boyfriend into the house. So, yeah, they're not such a homophobic parent group, are
no
they?
No the problem that they have no real issue with them being gay, and they never have.
Yeah, but of course teen angst ensues. I think they're supposed to be around 17, and Billy gets mad at Teddy because Teddy's been sneaking out and superheroing at night, which is, you know, they've agreed not to do that. And then Teddy has a kind of a breakdown and starts crying because his mom's dead and he wishes that she was still alive. And he, you know, which reminds me of like that thing that happens when somebody gets mad at you for something and then you change the subject by making something else sad.
I know, but like Teddy had a lot of really good points, which was that in a way, you know, his life has been a lot harder than Billy's life has. Yeah. And so for Billy to be mad at him is kind of a little, it's not completely absurd, but it's a little absurd.
Yeah. And I love this scene. I mean, it's also like, remember how it took, I don't know how many issues in the first run to get to the point where Billy and Teddy could kiss? Like, it took forever, right? And then in the first, like, 4 pages or 10 pages of this one, we get, like, a giant kiss. We get the two of them having a total emotional scene with, you know, the crying and all the things. Teddy even says to Billy, like, aren't we sickening, you know?
Yes, because they're just, like, yeah.
So ridiculously cute together, yeah. But as a result of the breakdown that Teddy has, Billy decides to use his reality warping powers, which is kind of never a good idea. To resurrect
Teddy's dead mother, yeah.
Yeah.
Billy's mother is alive at this point. Scarlet Witch is alive, though, you know, sometimes she's not. But Teddy's mother is who he tries to resurrect, but he ends up pulling out this other mother who's this sort of squishy interdimensional being that does evil things that no adults can notice.
Right. So she, in the morning, it seems like she's fine. You know, he goes downstairs. She's alive. They hug. Everything's okay. Teddy goes back to sleep. When he wakes up in the morning, they go downstairs, and the mother has kind of possessed Billy's parents.
Oh, yeah.
And she is now this, like, yeah, she has this power to kind of make her arms squishy and, like, suck it, like, people's brains and make them possessed. And, you know, it's very unclear what she is exactly, but we get the sense that she's kind of interdimensional, weird problem person.
Yep.
And they eventually say she's a psychic parasite. And this is what kind of gets the whole story going.
That clears it up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, yeah, how many psychic parasites have we had to deal with in comics?
A lot. Cassandra Nova pops immediately into my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, the what's his name? The Shadow King.
Of course, yeah.
Then we kind of find out that the other characters in the book, America Chavez, Novar, all these people have been, their own dead parents are manifesting as these kind of monstrous golems and attacking them and telling them things like, we know what's right for you. You know, how could you be so ungrateful?
Right.
Like that. Then when Teddy and Billy go to visit the Scarlet Witch, Billy's actual mom, to kind of get the Avengers help, it seems like all the Avengers, including Captain America and Scarlet Witch, all are kind of on the side of the parents, even though they can't quite perceive the threat that's coming from those interdimensional golem parasite.
No full-blown adults can understand what's happening and how reality is being altered here.
So the team starts to form, you know, around this problem, and Loki is involved in all of it and has been sort of suggesting that, you know, it's all Billy who's caused all this, and that Billy should probably be dealt with in some way. At one point toward the end of this first book, Billy pulls out one of Novar's guns and wants to shoot himself in the head to kill himself so the monster will go away, which I found really disturbing. That moment was weird for me because I'm like, the gay teenager pulls a gun out and tries to kill himself. Oh, man.
Well, it's heavy, but it's not inaccurate.
No, it's not. And it's a thing with Billy, I think, in this whole book. In this one, Teddy and Billy are really central here in a way that in the original first run, anyway, before Children's Crusade, they were kind of the kind of background-y guys that you were like always like, what's going on with those two, you know, Asgardian and Hulkling?
The center was really Iron Lad of that first Young Avengers bit.
So here we get to see them more and understand their personalities, and Billy, he does have a bit of a guilt feeling in general. He just kind of feels bad. And I think it's because his powers are just too crazy, right? I mean, he can warp reality. So at the end of this book, he gets a really, I think, very nice new costume. It has sparkly stars in it. It has a beautiful red riding hood.
It's a little bit like the Troia costume, where Donna Troy is sort of wearing constellations.
Yeah, and then this book ends, but not before Loki has planted in Teddy's head the possibility that his reality-warping boyfriend Billy created Teddy to be his boyfriend with his evil use of his superpowers, but even though he didn't intend to, he accidentally did it. That's what Loki, who is, of course, God of Mischief, plants in our boy Teddy's head. And have you ever, okay, this is a side note, but when I read that, I thought it was so great because I have had this fear. I've been with my boyfriend for over 20 years. I've had this fear sometimes that he's not real and I made him up. And sometimes when we're in public, like if I lose track of him, I think, oh my God, now I'm going to find out that he never existed.
I think it's a version of a fear that I've definitely had and you hear other people have, which is just that the entire world is all like actors and they're all just like Truman showing you all the time. And when you leave, they all just sort of like sit around and have like a coffee break and smoke cigarettes. That's I think part of what's going on here. And it's a sort of a classic part of the sort of Scarlet Witch mythos. So mm-hmm. it's not a, it's a good pull from the Marvel playbook.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think in my particular case, I think it's just this idea that you accidentally invented your boyfriend. It's like he's too good.
Yeah, I feel and like so that of course sometimes, he's not definitely, real. Yeah.
Okay, so then we get to book two. This one's called Alternative Culture. I mean, the titles are a bit too cute, probably, but I kind of love them. I can't help it. You know what it is? Somebody said this to me when I was really young. I didn't know what the word pretentious meant. But somebody said to me, well, it's better if something's pretentious than stupid. And then I looked up what pretentious was, and I realized that just saying that was both pretentious and stupid, but also totally, I agreed.
So, yeah, it's pretty much true.
So, okay, in the very first issue of this, we have a different artist. It's Kate Brown. And this book, the first issue, just focuses on Prodigy, and he's now working at a superhero call center. He meets Tommy, a.k.a. Speed, at this, like, dead-end job. So that's Tommy is Billy's brother, who has super speed powers. And they're both working at this dead-end job, and they just kind of become friends and have, like, lunch a couple of times. There's a really great four-page spread of panels of David just answering the phone, which is, like, a perfect job for him if he's not going to be a superhero, giving information to people since he seems to know everything.
And it's, like, information about how to deal with a Super Skrull and what kind of, like, Reed Richards equipment you need, and then someone's on the phone with him while they're fighting Elektra, and he's, like, basically explaining that to them, and then they're, like, sort of arguing with him and disagreeing with him sort of snappily. It's really very funny, and Kate Brown's pencils are really great, and she actually does the colors here, and I don't know how she, what technique she's using, but she gives them this sort of grainy quality, like almost like you're reading a film, and I really enjoyed it a lot. This was the first issue of the book I read back when it was coming out and was getting a lot of hype, and it got me really excited for the rest of the series, but I will admit, Jamie McKelvey's art is not my favorite, and so I kind of lost interest after this one.
I mean, it's one of the rare moments where a fill-in artist does make you think, like, oh, that's, like, I'd like to stick with them for a little longer.
Sure, yeah.
Like, you know, but it also makes that particular issue really special. So at the end of this issue, a ghostly version of Patriot. Remember him? Who's he again?
Patriot is the grandson of the sort of original Captain America, who in a sort of wild narrative twist of events, they reveal that before Steve Rogers, they experimented the Captain America serum mostly on Black Americans, which is very dark and tragic. But he was the grandson of one of those original Captain Americas. He was the sort of Captain America stand-in in the original series who had a drug problem with mutant growth hormone, which always annoyed me because it really undercut the character a lot.
So in a weird way, the fact that he shows up just as like this twisted, distorted version of himself, and then he whisks Speed away into another universe, so now David is involved. I think it's kind of interesting he kind of haunts this. It's almost like Kieran Gillen and McKelvey kind of being like, well, even though we don't want to deal with that character, he's haunting this the way that he was treated sort of haunts the Young Avengers.
It sure does, yeah.
No matter what we do. Okay, so meanwhile, the team is just going around in outer space and other places. We don't see a lot of that. We see a little bit of that. But they're having all these adventures while trying to avoid the mother character here on Earth. And they do communicate this through a kind of social media. So there's a couple of pages where it's just these spreads of, like, you know, kind of Instagram photos with, like, commentary underneath amongst the characters.
Oh, sure.
Your favorite thing. but Genius David tracks them all down at a diner and tells them about the whole Patriot and Speed thing in order to get them involved. And the kids know who David is because Billy and Teddy are nerds, and they know about him on, like, some kind of Wikipedia page or something. So they follow him, and this is where America reveals that she has the power to kick through universes and sort of leads them now into these alternate worlds, which is where this whole alternative culture thing comes. And they call them Mayfly dimensions. In these dimensions, they see all these crazy versions of themselves gone wrong. And so it's kind of like meta commentary on legacy characters, which is what they all are as well.
With a few exceptions, yeah. They're all based on other characters. Yep.
And then eventually, the not Patriot character leads them to this sort of blank paneled world where the mother is. Teddy and David get stuck there while the rest of the team runs off into yet another one of these dimensions to get away from her. This is also an interesting thing because the way that her universe now exists is it's like just these sort of white panels. And some of them even have the kind of wireframe drawings of superhero characters in the panels. So it's sort of like this intense deconstruction of the whole, like, superhero thing, which is something, or even like comics and more broadly, which is something that becomes more and more a theme as this book gets into this kind of meta space. But there's a big thing that happens here, and this is, I think, probably one of the biggest, most controversial things that happens in this book, is that while David and Teddy are stuck in this dimension together, David just turns around and kisses Teddy in a full page, like a splash page. And then in the next issue, he comes out as bi. So what did you think about this?
Well, I didn't love it, not because I didn't like the idea that David was bi. I mean, it actually kind of makes sense if you're constantly absorbing other people's, like, skills, I guess you could say, for you to be very, you know, sexually open or fluid or interested in different things. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't feel like it quite fit the character as I'd seen him so far, because he seemed sort of like a bit uptight and very sort of straight-laced. But I was glad to have more sort of gay characters in the mix. I was still feeling a little sensitive to the way they were treating black characters after the way Patriot got treated in the first book. Mm-hmm. And so to have David come off as kind of a jerk was, like, didn't feel like the right move, because then this the sole black character on the team is getting all this hate piled on to them online by these other gays, you know, and it's like, why do they have to do this to the fictional characters on top of real people, you know what I mean?
That makes sense. Sexuality is really messy, and that a lot of the times I think superheroes with their sexualities, that's the area that they kind of like keep the most sort of conservative and cordoned off, particularly gay characters or queer characters, because they've had such a bad history of representation in the past. People are very careful about what they do with them. And in this instance, I kind of got it. I felt like he was caught in this random dimension, thought they were never going to get out, and he was overtaken with desire, the way that a lot of us have been with Billy and Teddy this whole time, with the two of them just like wandering around being such thirst traps for gay fans. And in a weird way, he was everybody, you know. He was all of us readers.
Sure,
just turned around one day and
just
kissed Teddy once for all, who, by the way, of course, is green in the panel where he kisses him. Can we just read a little bit of that page that follows it, where David talks a little bit about why he did that and what he was feeling?
Sure. I'll be Teddy and you can be David.
Okay.
Seriously, talk. What was that about? I mean, I'm complimented, but taken and what?
It's simple and complicated. Basically, if we're actually going to die here, I had to know what it was like to kiss you. I kind of hope we do die now.
You're gay, though? Since when? Your wiki page needs an update.
I'm bi. Never said that aloud. I realized, well, you know how my power works, picking up everything except powers from people? Well, I got everything, skills, talents, and some other stuff. And when my mutation went crazy and I got everything I'd ever absorbed, I got everything.
Oh, wow. That's a trip. Wasn't it strange?
No. That's the strange thing. It was like an awakening. It was like realizing something that was always true, and I just couldn't see it until now. It was like all the rooms in my head opening. You know, and they go on to talk, and like, actually, I think Teddy is quite nice to him about this. Okay, let's keep going. Didn't matter, though. In the last few years, I've always been about the work, mutant kind, saving the world, never really left time to, well, be with anyone. And now, facing death? You're so good with Billy. Who wouldn't want a slice of that, even for a second? Everyone says how perfect you are together. And I don't think they see it's only perfect because of you.
Ha! You know nothing, David Aline. Which is a Game of Thrones reference. We're a mess. A happy mess, but a mess. Mostly I'm scared to death. He's a reality warper. I suspect he could be making me love him. Not deliberately or anything, but...
Yeah, I'd hate that. You know, if I were you, if I got out of here, I'd get some space to see if it clears my head.
But I love his look here with the like yellow goggles. It's so great.
Yeah. I mean, he has this really nice fade, and then his glasses have a kind of fade in them too.
That's
and
true, yeah.
I love that he's repping the black and yellow. He's like, because, you know, at this point, this was when, like, there's always an X-Man on every Avengers team. So I'm glad he gets to be the X-Man that's on the Avengers team as sort of the, you know, mutant, like, representative or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so he does do a little manipulative kind of funny thing at the end there, which isn't 100% wrong.
No, he's not wrong.
In terms of advice. But, yeah. But I think his explanation there is really nice. And in a lot of ways, it's a way of talking about coming out, and particularly coming out as bi, which is like a very different thing than saying necessarily like, here's my gay identity. But rather he's saying like, a door in my mind opened up. You know?
Right.
I love it. Let's keep going. So, you know, there's all this stuff where the two boys take time off, and Billy realizes at this point, by the way, that he will someday become the demiurge. Do you know what that term is? It's really weird. It comes from Gnosticism, and it's like an ancient Greek concept of this artisan god who creates the universe. I like that name.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I think that should just be his code name, because Wiccan is horrible. And
Wiccan's horrible.
And the writers acknowledge it here and maybe in like other books.
They say that Hulkling is awful, too, and they're both... terrible names, and Demiurge is a much better name. So anyway, he's a Demiurge. He's going to become this like superpowered thing. Teddy joins a support group with all these funny exes of the team, including Ultimate Nullifier, who is such a like disgusting. He has like Guy Fieri hair.
Oh yeah.
And there's a really funny moment where they're sitting around in the circle in this room, and they're doing this sort of support group thing about being exes of the Young Avengers. And Teddy just says, "You guys are all crazy stalkers," and then runs out of the room. I love that panel where he says, "You're all crazy stalkers," and I just want to like use that panel on Twitter all the time.
Yeah.
And just send it to everybody. But anyway, and then he runs out of the room, and the mother gets him. And then the next book starts, which is Mike Drop at the Edge of Space and Time. And this one is like three issues that kind of wrap up the whole story, and then two issues that are actually just an after party for the other issues. This kind of becomes like a very much a parents just don't understand kind of thing, because what happens is, in order to fight these alternative versions of themselves that are being pulled in as an army to take over the Earth by the mother, they have to unite with all the other young superheroes of the world. And David basically, through social media, contacts all these young superheroes. And so we have this kind of moment where like all the kind of tween or teen characters of Marvel unite against this army, and all the adults can't see the problem.
Yeah, they're right? Just like, just work out your differences.
Then, you know, there's a kind of love conquers all moment, basically. I mean,
oh, it's
Teddy
great.
And, I mean, the art is really beautiful in this portion of the book.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, the day is saved by love. Love wins, because it's like sort of like queer love reignites the universe type of a vibe.
The thing that's funny to me is like, in the original book, they were like it took forever to get to the point where Billy and Teddy could kiss, and it was like they were spied on by Kate through a window when it happened, and they were in the middle of like their bedroom, and it was all very like hush hush, and like this is like they're floating in the center of the universe kissing, you know, and like the stars are just exploding out of them. So for me, that's a nice kind of centering, let's say, of queer desire and queer experience.
It really was. And it was like almost to the point where you kind of felt like the entire run was kind of building up to allow this moment to happen.
Yeah.
And that was a great feeling, because you do not often feel that way as a as a gay reader of comics. No. And it definitely made the whole book worth it for me.
Yeah. And so at the very end, there's this like two issue after party where it's a lot of different guest artists are doing little scenes where the characters are talking to each other. And, you know, Novar and Kate break it off. And she's kind of fine with it because she gets it. He was like a total fuckboy, right? And I'm glad that she wasn't all tripping. Billy has to talk to David about how he kissed Teddy. Billy and Teddy wear kind of cute shirts at the party, and you know they're happy. Loki and David have a weird moment, which I thought was interesting, where Loki wants to kiss David because it's like New Year's or something, but Loki says that he doesn't, or David says he likes good guys. He's not really his type,
right?
Loki at this point has aged. Yeah, that part's good, right? And Loki aged up at this point, and I thought he looked really sexy as like sexy teen Loki. I love his hair. He's got like black fingernail polish on. I don't know. I mean, it's a type.
He looks good. Yeah, he's a type. Then Prodigy also kind of more or less figures out who is behind the mask of the weird Patriot figure, and it turns out that character was actually a sort of guardian angel all along.
Yeah.
Which was a funny twist that I was not expecting.
And then they kiss, which is just really bizarre. And then Speed is back all of a sudden. And so that's good. And then America kind of just says, by the way, I'm a lesbian. I have been all along. And she's sort of been hinting it, but she never really like had to come out before. But now it kind of becomes the thing. Novar admits that he's experimented with gay sex.
Mm-hmm.
And Kate says she's the only straight one on the team. She kind of realized she was the only straight one the whole time, or the only exclusively straight or straight identified. But one thing that Loki says that I thought was interesting here is like, we've got the alien boy, Novar, who experimented, and so he doesn't really think about sexuality the same way that we do on Earth. Loki says that in his world, in Asgard, they think about sex acts. They don't think about sexual identity.
Right.
Which I thought was really interesting. At the end of this book, we realized that, like, while a lot of it was about this anxiety of identity and parental desire for what you should be doing and control of the parents, and then also who you could be if you were another person from another dimension, all that stuff, that really sexuality was the subject the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, that was never quite in doubt for me. I mean, it feels like a bit of a shoehorn moment, because this book had acquired a lot of gay fans. And when this issue hit, it kind of echoed through the Tumblrverse. Like, you know, the first all-gay super team, or the first all-queer super team at Marvel, you know? And I was, like, kind of annoyed by that, because, like you were saying, like, with X-Men right now, it feels kind of weird how the women and the men are kind of split up into two different groups, and the queer characters and the women... And, you know, if there's not like a sort of plausible reason for that in the narrative, I kind of get annoyed, because it feels like what you were saying, a little bit of a marketing strategy. Brian Wood's X-Men, I think, is another example of that. And I really prefer books like Runaways, for example, which is like a mostly female team, because it's completely plausible and still lets the female characters sort of be the driving force of the book. However, I will say that, you know, based on what we know about these characters, it's all very plausible for pretty much all of them to be queer because of, you know, the reasons they mentioned, even though it was kind of thrown in here right at the end and, like, couldn't really be explored past that, it's still all completely believable, you know what I mean?
Totally.
And I love when they comics does this thing, and we've talked about this with Shatterstar a lot, where it sort of engages with this idea that sexuality and gay identity are very specific to our own culture, our Western right. culture, or our American culture, or our Earth culture. And so if you're right. if you're not from Earth, or you're an alien or a god, or from a, you know, mayfly dimension or whatever, the yeah. the rules around sexuality could be sort of outside of the realm of our own imagining. And I really like that possibility. So
yeah, I mean, I think we feel maybe slightly differently about this, but and I may have felt differently about this in the past than you, in terms of the question about how teams form around particular identities. Sometimes with the more diverse group kind of model, you get a kind of tokenism that I think when you have a team, say, for example, who all have some are on some kind of spectrum of queerness, or when you have characters like the that Ultimates book that America Chavez was also in, where it was a majority black characters. What I like about that, and you see that in some of the X-Men stuff that's coming out right now with some queer characters, is that they are not the gay guy or the woman on the team, but then you get like a broader range and of kind of types of people who can identify with a particular you know, status. When I was in college, or when I was in high school, I had a lot of straight friends. I had friends from all over the place because we were all in that situation together. And so that makes sense to me when that happens. But at the same time, when you think about like who are my friends now that I'm like an adult in New York City, I mean, to be perfectly honest, the people I hang out with, and it's not just, I mean, you know, there are people that I like who are all over the place, but people I hang out with, they're mostly queer. Most of them are actually Latinx. And we have a lot in common. And so I think about that too, is like, if I was in the superhero team, I don't know, maybe I'd really want to be with other people who were more like me than not, which is totally against the like idealism of intersectionality. But right now, at this point in time, I mean, there's something about like not having to like have some straight white person in the center of my existence that's kind of nice.
To clarify a little bit more, like, for example, Ta-Nehisi Coates did a book called The Crew, which was pretty much all yeah. black superheroes. I think it was all black superheroes. But they were kind of explaining, the narrative kind of explained to you why this right, group right. needed to be all black, I guess what you're saying. But no, right. I agree yeah. with you. Like, a group we've talked about before on the show is called We the Geeks of East LA, and they do Power Rangers cosplay, and they reenact mm-hmm. episodes of Power Rangers, but they're all... Mm-hmm. They're all Latinx, and so it sort of posits its question where, like, you know, if East LA was under attack, who would be chosen to be the Power Rangers? Right. It wouldn't be like a team with one black guy and one Asian girl right. who are then made the black mm-hmm. and yellow ranger. I mean, that's right. the real insanity of that's, that one. But
right.
but
right,
it would
right,
be. Right. The people from that area, which are all yeah. Latinx. So, no, I'm not saying that can never happen. It didn't feel like there was an explanation as to why. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I know what you mean. And yet, at the same time, I guess I feel like it's interesting to me that, like, the Avengers have been around for 1 million years, and every single member has always been straight, you know?
Yeah.
Like, well, now we have a team where, like, they're all on the spectrum, and even at the end when Kate says I'm the only straight one on the team, who turns around but Miss America Chavez looks at her and says, "You're not that straight," and I love that, you know. So I don't know. It's a certain thing that happens in this book that I feel like never is going to happen again. Maybe it will.
I hope it will.
Well, one thing about this. We could talk about for just a second is the legacy of this book. I mean, it had a huge impact on people. People were really into it. It lasted for 15 issues. There hasn't been anything quite like it from Marvel since. And yet I have heard that this is one of the things they're looking at to possibly make a film of. I don't know, maybe they're doing the Hindenburg version, but in any case, Young Avengers is something that they're looking at for Marvel Phase 12 or whatever. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, they got to look somewhere. You know what I mean? I mean, they're, yeah. it's wild to me that they have Doom Patrol and Umbrella Academy TV shows and right. two films about Ant-Man. Like, we've really right. been stretched to the limit, like, in yeah. terms of content. Yeah. I would almost prefer this be a TV show just because they're so complicated, mm-hmm. these characters. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. you know, I'm definitely interested in that happening, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting that here we have characters who are popular and kind of tried and true to a degree, but they've never really had like a long run. So there's a lot more, in some ways, a lot more freedom though there. I mean, I can only imagine the outcry if people can't even handle a militaristic white woman superhero, what they would do with gay superheroes. But I would love to see it, frankly. I think that they are kind of perfect for film adaptation in some ways, although there's so many different ways they can get America Chavez wrong on film. It makes me a little nervous. But, you know, there we go. One thing I really like about this book was the art, and I know you had issues with Jamie McKelvey.
Yeah, he's not my favorite artist, and I think it comes down to something we've talked about before, which is just a difference in the way we consume comic book art. Which is like you are really detail oriented and I just kind of power through, which means that sometimes you get a little more easily overwhelmed and sometimes I miss a lot of details. But Jamie McKelvey, sometimes his art just feels a little too rigid to me. It kind of, the artist I kept thinking of when I was reading it was actually Steve Dillon, who drew the Preacher comics, who couldn't be more sort of politically
sensibility
different.
Wise
In terms of the content, but just the sort of figure making style. And then also I kind of sometimes when I see Jamie McKelvey's art, I kind of just want to see the Hernandez brothers art for some reason. That's another person who I often find my group that I often find myself being recalled to. But I will say that he does do inventive things with paneling that interests me, that I like.
Yeah. Yeah, he plays a lot with the way that the layout is and sort of storytelling works in a comics. And I love that kind of like kind of medium specific critique. You know, I'm a sucker for anything like that. As I've said, pretension is my preference. but I just am literally attracted to the characters. I think the emotions that he draws are, I kind of am able to buy them because there's like sometimes a kind of irony in them. So like there's this really beautiful moment when the mom figure is trying to give Teddy like strawberry ice cream or something. And he says, strawberry is my favorite, but he looks like he's going to cry. It's just like, I don't know, for me, like, that moment, I'm just like, I buy it so hard. And then I love America's costumes. That's why I thought of it just now. But I love the way he draws her style. I think the close-ups are so good. It is really, really clean to the point where it does have a kind of suspended animation quality to it. And I think I'm a sucker for really, really clean art. I think it's also the coloring is really good with the line art. And so for me, actually, this book is what a lot of these characters look like. Like when I picture Teddy, I picture this version of Teddy. When I picture America, I do picture this America first. And so it also has to do with maybe when I first kind of really got into the Young Avengers, it was through this work. So it just kind of sticks for me. Yeah. Well, that was fun talking about
it. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I wish there were more books like this to talk about.
I sure do. I certainly do wish that. But it's funny, we keep thinking we're going to hit a wall with gay content, and we do sort of keep opening up the Russian nesting doll and finding new topics. Yeah. And hopefully that will continue.
Yeah, hopefully. And hopefully they'll, you know, these characters will still be people that we can track and follow and see how they develop and see what happens when the Young Avengers start to grow up.
Yeah.
If that's possible.
They're starting to grow up here for me a little bit, seeing some of them, you know, have like pretty tangible sex lives was a big jump from the earlier days.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kate is a little older, so she gets to actually admit to having sex, whereas Billy and Teddy still kind of, you're always like, have they?
Yeah, who knows?
What have they done?
The door has to stay open, but...
The door has to stay open. There's been some rubbing.
Yeah.
Super Gay is produced by James Kelly, and we are
recorded in New York City at my apartment, but also at Razorcake Studios in Los Angeles. And you can find us on Apple Podcast, and we are also on Linoleum Knife's RSS feed, and we want to thank Linoleum Knife.
And we want to tell you to go listen to all their podcasts, Linoleum Knife, Linoleum Knife and Fork, their food podcast. There's even Linoleum Nights, the podcast where they curse. That's all on their Patreon. And follow those guys on their social media, because They're very funny, especially Dave. And Alonzo is always popping up here and there on CNN or who knows where to talk about film. So get a hold of those guys because they've got some good things to say about TV and movies.
Yeah, and then follow us and support us on Patreon. You'll be able to get new podcast content from Johnny that's been being taped right now and is really fun and great, and other new stuff that we'll be sharing there, and that'll be a great way to get in touch with us. And then, you know, I hope to see you guys in about 6 months at the FlameCon in New York City.
Yes, the mecca of gay comics fandom. I cannot wait.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun. All right, have a super gay month, guys.
Have a super gay month.
Bye. Super K.